it's been my perception that there is an intense spiritual longing, common to many of us, a longing that just doesn't seem to find a place of centering in our modern world. For a large number of people, Christianity has died in a strange way. The myths have died. We cannot find ourselves, many of us, a place within the collectivities of modern Christianity. We were raised religious traditions, and yet, in our maturity, find difficulty relating from the depth of our own soul to the outward forms and manifestations of those traditions. And yet, we know that there's something in us which longs for otherness, for the divine. We sense within ourselves the possibility of a dimension outside of this materiality of our flesh, a dimension that calls to us with a greatness and with a transcendence. But we find no path to it. We find no established formal path to it. In our culture, more generally, I have sensed that this longing to find the thing lost has taken manifestation in a particular recent projection upon the figure of Mary of Magdala. It may have been consolidated by Dan Brown's best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code, with its literary myth of Mary as the wife of Jesus and the mother of children. But it was finding form long before that. In the last few decades, as people have become aware of the importance of this figure, Mary of Magdala, in early Christianity, there's been a real awakening that indeed at least a piece of a story may have been missed from early Christianity, may have been improperly conveyed or perhaps even suppressed, that there may be something, some important element in this mythos, in this religious tradition that we missed. And maybe that thing that we missed was the important thing. Maybe that was the thing that will bring it into a context of meaning for us. And so, as I've mentioned on the internet page I maintain called the Gnosis Archives, where I have a huge amount of literature related to ancient Gnosticism, including the texts of most of the major Gnostic writings and early Christian writings, I find that the one term that brings millions of people actually to this site is Mary of Magdala. I get reports from Google as to what search term brought people to the Gnosis Archive. Month after month, for the last 5 years, the term that most likely brought people to my site with hosting Gnostic Gospels is the search term Mary of Magdala. Mary has become a center of a projection, outward of a content that we're seeking for, something that seems perhaps to have been lost that we now wish to find. And indeed, this Mary of Magdala was an important figure in the literature of, I should say, the suppressed and lost literature of the early Christian tradition. That literature has been refound in the last century or two, found at Nag Hammadi in the form of 55 forgotten, lost texts, found in earlier editions, earlier books of ancient origin, one called the Bruce Codex, another called the Askew Codex, and another important text known as the Berlin Gnostic Codex, found in the late 1800s. And it is this particular volume that contained an extraordinary little book called The Gospel of Mary of Magdala. And so we'll turn to that gospel this evening and consider it. But first, let me talk about the image of this Mary of Magdala in traditional Christian literature, in the canon literature. First of all, her name, Mary. Mary the Magdalene. Mary of Magdala. She's referred to only by her name and by her city of birth in traditional literature. Mary appears as a witness, and perhaps a principal witness, of the events relating to the life of Jesus in traditional literature. She participates in the Galilean career of Jesus of Nazareth. She follows him to Jerusalem. She stands by at his execution and his burial. And then, according to traditional accounts, she becomes the first or one of the first witnesses of his resurrection. Now, despite her importance in the gospel narrative, and most especially in light of her role as the first apostle, the first messenger of the resurrection, the one who finds the empty tomb and the risen Lord, traditional accounts offer little information about her. She is identified, once again, by the city of her birth only. Unlike many other women in the gospel, most of the time when you have in the traditional Christian literature known as the New Testament and the Gospels, the four, most of the time when you have the name of a woman mentioned, it is attached in adjective and description to the sister of, the wife of, the mother of. This is how women are identified in the literature, but not Mary of Magdala. She comes only with name and place of birth, unattached to mother, father, sister, husband. There are lots of women, however, in the New Testament account by the name of Mary. And this makes tracking the story of Mary of Magdala a little bit different, because her story keeps getting conflated. There are three or perhaps five or maybe even seven different women by the name of Mary identified. And often the name Mary is just used alone, and it's difficult to say which one it is. So it makes it a little bit difficult to understand her. But specifically, speaking of Mary of Magdala, we have a very few accounts. There's an identification in the Gospel of Luke where it is stated that Mary and several other women traveled with Jesus in Galilee and, quote, served them out of their means, or ministered to them out of their means. It appears that these women perhaps were women of possession, of money, and they're actually able to help support the ministry by supplying food, finding lodging, and perhaps even providing financial assistance. It's a brief verse. Scholars have read it in that fashion. In Luke, she is also specifically again identified as a woman from whom seven demons came out. What this means is unclear. Some people have suggested that it's a slander against her, or at least a negative quality. I would respond that, in my experience, most human beings are possessed by far more than seven demons. And also in my experience, in most cases, those demons haven't come out yet. Or at least they're coming out one by one, and they're coming out in front of me. I work as an emergency room doctor, so I spend many evenings encountering demons coming out of people. So in a sense, one might say that this woman who has exorcised the demons might be considered a positive as well as a negative commentary. But most important in traditional Christian literature is the scene in the Gospel of John, where she goes to the grave of Jesus after the crucifixion and finds the tomb empty. And as she leaves, a figure appears to her. And she says, "Where have they taken my Lord?" And the figure, it becomes apparent, is the risen Lord. This is the only scene in traditional literature where Mary of Magdala speaks to Jesus, in this case, the risen Jesus, recognizes him, and then he commissions her, Mary, to go to the other apostles and give to them notice of his resurrection. Now, in traditional view, this makes Mary an apostle. Apostle simply means messenger. And in the Latin liturgy, Mary of Magdala is referred to as the Apostola Apostolorum, the apostle to the apostles. She's the first apostle. She is the apostle, the messenger who takes the message of a risen Lord to the others. This is the first testimony. Outside of these, of the four gospel narratives, there's no mention of Mary of Magdala in any of the other Christian texts, the letters, the Acts. And that's it. That's what we know of Mary from tradition. But what about the story then of Mary the harlot, the repentant prostitute? Where did that come from? Well, good question. Where did it come from? And this is where the issue of conflation comes in. There are many other scenes in the New Testament involving women. There are particularly three important scenes where women anoint Jesus during his lifetime. And Mary of Magdala in Christian tradition has always been identified as the word is the mirror for, the one who carries the mirror, the anointing ointment. Often in medieval and later Christian iconography and art, you find Mary of Magdala represented carrying a jar of anointing potion because she was going to anoint the body of the Lord in the tomb. Well, there are stories earlier in the life of Jesus where anointing takes place. In Mark and Matthew, Jesus' head is anointed by an unnamed woman. In John, Mary, the sister of Lazarus and Martha of Bethany, anoints Jesus' feet with perfume. And then, even more importantly, and this is where the story of the prostitute centers in Luke, an unnamed woman in the city who was a sinner wets Jesus' feet with her tears and wipes the feet with her hair and kisses his feet and anoints them with ointment. This identification of Mary of Magdala with the figure of a prostitute, a fallen woman, is really a late development in Christian mythology. And it seems to take principal form with Pope Gregory in the 6th century, who gives a sermon identifying all of these figures as related to the figure of Mary of Magdala. And from that point on, the myth of Mary grows, and this identification as Mary, as a prostitute, as a fallen woman, increases. But in the early Christian literature of traditional sources, what we call the patristic literature, the literature written by the church fathers writing in the late 2nd and 3rd century, never make this identification of Mary as a prostitute. In Gnostic literature, and by this I mean speaking in a broad sense of Gnostic literature, and it might be better to say in the literature recently discovered of early Christianity, which has been related to a brand of Christianity suppressed by Orthodoxy subsequently, a brand of Christianity, a view of Christianity that differed enough from what became mainstream Orthodox Christianity that it was suppressed and that its documents were eventually destroyed and hidden away in cases. In this brand of Christianity, the one that was lost, Mary of Magdala plays a very important role. And the role she played is, shall we say, much more fleshed out. In the texts, the ancient texts of this lost Christianity, we find Mary described as prominent among the followers of Jesus of Nazareth. She exists as a character, as a living memory, in a textual world that is, at that time, androcentric, man-centered in its language, and patriarchal in its ideology. We do not find prominent women in traditional, accepted, surviving Christian literature, surviving within the mainstream. This Mary of Magdala in the forgotten texts of the Nag Hammadi Library and the other collections I mentioned, the Bruce Codex, the Askew Codex, the Berlin Gnostic Codex, in these texts, she speaks boldly, and she speaks, something we find very little of in traditional literature. And she plays a leadership role in relation to the male disciples. She's also a visionary. She in many of these texts has relation to a risen Lord in vision, and she conveys these visions and their interpretations to the other disciples. The other disciples in these texts often praise her for her superior understanding. And lastly, and importantly, particularly importantly to modern fictional literature, she is identified as an intimate companion of Jesus. And of course, it's that last point, number 7, that titillates the modern age at a certain level. Well, first let me just speak about her prominence. And give just a few examples. I know many of you are probably not deeply familiar, if familiar at all, with some of the texts I'm going to mention. But first, in the Gospel of Thomas that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. The Gospel of Thomas is identified as perhaps the oldest surviving Christian gospel. It's a collection of 114 sayings of the living Jesus, recorded by Didymus Judas Thomas. It may date before any of the surviving canonical texts. And in the Gospel of Thomas, Mary is one of 6 disciples who are named. One of 6. Only 5 of these disciples speak to Jesus and ask him questions, and Mary is one of them. And when she does speak, it appears she speaks for the group. There's another text known as the Wisdom or the Sophia of Jesus Christ. This text was found both in the Nag Hammadi collection and it was found in the Berlin Gnostic Codex, another book discovered, as I mentioned, in the late 1800s with the Gospel of Mary. The Sophia of Jesus Christ and the Gospel of Mary were found bound together in one of these codices. In the Sophia of Jesus Christ, there are 7 male and 12 male disciples who are gathered in Galilee with the Redeemer after he has risen from the dead and before he ascends. 5 of these disciples are named. Mary is one of them. 5 ask him questions. Mary is one of them. See, she's standing up with the male figures in equality, if not in superiority to them. In the Gospel of Philip, which was discovered at Nag Hammadi, Mary is described as the companion of the Lord and is said to have always walked with him, as did his mother and his sister, both named Mary. And it says then, his sister and his mother and his companion were each a Mary. His sister and his mother and his companion were each a Mary. In Pistis Sophia, which means faithful wisdom, in Pistis Sophia, a text that was found first translated in the early 1900s, we have an extensive rendition of dialogues between the disciples and the risen Lord, and principal spokesman often in these dialogues and in these questionings of the Lord is Mary of Magdala, so identified. Pistis Sophia, depending on how you count it, includes about, maybe 100 or 120 questions that the disciples ask the risen Lord, seeking understanding. And these questions in Pistis Sophia that asked of the Lord, about 2/3 of them are voiced for the group by Mary of Magdala. And often, when an answer is given, the disciple is asked to explain the answer. And prominently and repeatedly, Mary is the one, Mary of Magdala, stands up and tells the other disciples what it is the Lord is saying, what this revelatory saying of the Lord means. And once again, remember, this is a post-resurrectional teaching. The disciples are meeting the risen Lord in vision. So it's a visionary experience that she's involved in. And then subsequently in Manichaean Christianity, and I doubt too many of you know much about Manichaeism other than what one is taught in philosophical courses in college, that it was a nasty, violently dualistic heresy. But Manichaeans really considered themselves Christians. If you would have asked a Manichaean in the 3rd or 4th century what his religion was, he wouldn't have said, I'm a Manichaean. He would say, I'm a Christian. Mani, the founder of this movement, considered himself an apostle of Jesus Christ, and that's how he identified himself, and that's how his followers for a millennia after identified him. In Manichaean Christianity, then, I say, Mary again plays a prominent role in renditions, and she is called the Spirit of Wisdom, the Spirit of Sophia. With regard to her superior understanding, in Pistis Sophia, Jesus gives Mary Magdalene extensive praise. He says, she is blessed beyond all women on earth because she shall be the pleroma of all pleromas, which means the fullness of all fullnesses, and the completion of all completions, blessed among all generations. The Savior marvels at her answers to his questions and states, because she had completely become pure spirit. He says, you are she whose heart is more direct to the reign of heaven than all your brothers. What she knows and understands in Pistis Sophia is, of course, the risen, ascended Lord. And this is also presented as self-knowledge and knowledge of the authentic Christian community of life. To know this risen Lord in vision, in reality, in experience, is really the heart of this type of ancient Christianity. It's an encounter with the Logos, with the risen Lord, a direct experiential knowledge of this individual, which defines this esoteric brand of Christianity, subsequently called Gnostic Christianity. And then, specifically about this intimate companion of Jesus. Now, this is the part that, once again, has caught the interest of many people in our own age. In the Gospel of Philip, which is in large portion a sacramental gospel, it's a gospel with a variety of short passages talking about Gnostic theology, but also Gnostic sacramental practice, including mentioning a very sacred ritual called the mystery of the bride chamber. In Philip, it says the Lord taught all things in a mystery. A baptism, a chrism, a Eucharist, a redemption, and a bride chamber. These are the five definitions of the sacraments or the ritual actions taught by this Jesus of Nazareth. A baptism, well, we all are familiar with what that ritual is, at least in its modern outward manifestations. Chrism is represented perhaps in the ritual of anointing. Chrism means to anoint. Now seen in Christian ritual in the rite of confirmation, at least in some congregations where chrism is actually still placed. Eucharist, that's the Holy Supper. But then there are these two rituals mentioned in the Gospel of Philip, of which we know very little. One was called redemption, and the last, the highest, was known as the mystery of the bridal chamber. Well, anyway, in Philip, speaking of Mary, it says, and the companion of the Lord was Mary of Magdalene, and he loved her more than all the other disciples, and used to kiss her often on her mouth. The rest of the disciples said to him, why do you love her more than all of us? The Savior answered and said to them, why do I not love you like her? Well, there's a problem with this text. I just read you the common translation. The problem with the text is it has several lacuna. Areas where the papyrus has lost fragments. So there are little wormholes in this page where this passage occurs. And as people read the passage, they try to fill in the lacuna with the probable words. In other words, what word in Coptic would fit in this space and would make sense in this context, looking at all the text in general. And actually how the text reads, if you leave the blank spots there where the words have disappeared, it says, and the companion of the, and then there's a lacuna of a word or two, Mary Magdalene, and then there's another word or two missing that can't be read, loved her more than all the disciples, and used to kiss her often on her, and here there's a few words missing.
So, we knew he used to kiss her, but where? Under discussion. The rest of the disciples, then there's a blank part. They said to him, and then the rest is entirely intelligible, "Why do you love her more than all of us?" And the Savior answered and said to them, "Why do I not love you like her?" So this Mary that we find represented in these newly discovered, surviving testimonies of a type of forgotten, lost Christianity, which has been identified with the term gnosis, knowing. This Christianity has a very profound respect for the figure of Mary of Magdala. I spoke earlier in this series about apostolic traditions, that various of the apostles went to different geographic locations. They took with them their own understandings and their own revelatory, visionary knowledge, their own perception of the meaning of the ministry, death, and resurrection of the Lord. They founded movements that sometimes were compatible with, sometimes companion with, and sometimes in opposition to movements of other Christian apostles, movements in other geographical areas, or even those who called themselves Christian within similar communities. We know that there was a tradition of Thomas. There was a tradition of John. There was apparently a tradition of James. There is certainly a tradition centered upon Paul. It appears that also in early Christianity, Mary of Magdala played an apostolic role. She was seen as a principal disciple of this Jesus of Nazareth, one who understood him, one perhaps who understood him better than some of the other disciples. And there most certainly in early Christianity were groups who revered her as a disciple, apostle, messenger, perhaps consort and companion of the Lord in his earthly manifestation. So, we have this image of Mary, and now we have a book called The Gospel of Mary of Magdala. And let me just talk a little bit about this text. Various translations are available, including one that you can find on the internet on my website. Once again, the Gospel of Mary of Magdala was not found at Nag Hammadi. It was not in the collection there. It was found independently, I believe, in 1896. It was purchased by a German professor by the name of Reinhardt in Cairo. Where it came from, where it was found in Egypt, we really don't know. It appeared on the underground antiquities market down a back alley in Cairo, and this German fellow picked it up. It was bound in leather. It contained three important texts. It contained a text known as the Apocryphon of John that we talked about last week. It contained the Sophia of Jesus Christ, both of those texts also being found at Nag Hammadi in the Nag Hammadi collection. In other words, these were duplicate copies from an entirely different historical transmission that come into our hands. And then a text otherwise unknown called the Gospel of Mary. And the title is the Gospel of Mary. That this is Mary of Magdala that is being spoken of is very clear from the passages within the Gospel. Unfortunately, as with many of these old texts that come to us, the Gospel of Mary was fragmentary. Perhaps it was the most fragmentary of the books in the Berlin Gnostic Codex recovered. The original text was about 19 pages long, and the pages in the original edition were ordered and numbered, so we know what's missing. What's missing? Pages 1 through 6 and pages 11 through 14 of this 19-page document. So over half of it is gone. We're missing it. In addition to this Gospel of Mary found with the Berlin Gnostic Codex, subsequently it was discovered that a few other scraps of this Gospel had been found. Now, until we had a more complete text, it was impossible to identify these scraps. But I mentioned in prior lectures that there's been an excavation in a place called Oxyrhynchus in Upper Egypt, that was a trash pile of old manuscripts of Greek tradition, written in Greek. And as they'd gone through these various fragments, they found pieces of books of all sorts, including the Gospel of Thomas in Greek, original tradition. And then now we find that there are two scraps from Oxyrhynchus that are clearly from the Gospel of Mary. They are verbatim portions of the text as we have it. There may even be some fragments there from the parts of Mary and Magdala that were lost. Problem is, there's no way of putting them in context. But we do know that the Gospel of Mary Magdala existed in Greek translation, better stated, existed in original Greek. The version we have is a Coptic translation of an original Greek. But we know it existed in Greek. We know that at least two copies of it existed in this collection at Oxyrhynchus, where now we have fragments and scraps left in the dust of time for us to decipher. The Gospel of Mary, as it survives today, can be read in about 10 minutes. On each of these pages I mentioned, there are only 24 short lines of 7 or 8 words each. So the 9 or so pages we have left go pretty quick. But in the text, in the fragment we have, all of these characteristics that I mentioned of Mary of Magdala are represented all together. You know, I mentioned that in Gnostic literature, Mary is prominent among the followers of Jesus. She exists as a character, as a memory, in a textual world that is male-centered. She speaks boldly. She plays a leadership role. She's a visionary. She's praised for her superior understanding. And she's identified as an intimate companion of Jesus. In this fragment that we have of the Gospel of Mary, all of these characteristics are represented. Since it's brief, let me just read you a little bit of the text. In fact, I can probably read most of it and talk a little bit about what we have. As with many Gnostic texts, this text apparently starts with a dialogue with Jesus. Jesus is teaching his disciples. And remember, the first 6 pages are gone. So we don't know how this dialogue starts, but from reading many other Gnostic texts, it's clear that that's what's going on. They're having a conversation. And the Lord is teaching the disciples. And so we come to the top of page 7, the first page we have extant. The question is being asked, what is matter? And I'll just read from the text. So the question is asked by apparently the disciples of the Lord, what is matter? Will it last forever? The teacher answered, all that is born, all that is created, all the elements of nature are interwoven and united with each other. All that is composed shall be decomposed. Everything returns to its roots. Matter returns to the origins of matter. Those who have ears, let them hear. This is a common refrain in the Gnostic literature. Remember, those who have ears, let them hear. You who can perceive the meaning of this, listen. Hear. So this is the question. What is matter? Will it last forever? The way we see many people acting in this world, indeed the way I see myself acting in this world, day to day, the way we see, the way we act, would seem to indicate that we seem to think matter will last forever. I've been recently working on a huge and very exasperating remodel of a house we bought last August, the house that I was planning on living in until I die, which may be sooner or later, the way things are going. And I'm getting worked up about things that don't go right, that I'm messing with, you know, problems with the sanding of the floor, the moldings, the paint colors being wrong, you know, bad choices for tile. And my wife, Jacqueline, looked at me and says, what's going on? You think you're going to live forever? I mean, whatever it is, you're not going to have to put up with it for very long. Then relax. You know, it's an interesting perspective. Being told, don't worry about it, you are going to die. I remember a conversation I had with my mother when she was quite elderly. In fact, it was just about a year before she did die. And she had a bad tooth. And it was, you know, it was driving her crazy. And the dentist wanted to do an implantation. He told her if it wasn't done, probably the tooth would, you know, rot and fall out. And let me just step back and add, it's always easier to be wise when you're addressing other people, right? When you're giving other people advice, it's extremely easy to be wise. It's a little bit more hard when you're dealing with yourself, okay? So in this particular instance, I was the wise one and gave the advice sort of like my wife had given me about the pain. I said, Mom, look at the bright side. You may die before the tooth falls out. And she actually got a kick out of that. And indeed, she did die before the tooth fell out. That's the good news. But in all of our orientations, we treat matter as if it is the eternal thing, as if it is the centering fact. And indeed, the only fact we deal with. This moves not only from our personal preoccupations, but to our societal, to our intellectual, to our scientific orientations in this world. How much energy does this world spend on manipulating matter in various ways, relative to how much time the world, or perhaps we in our own worlds, spend to concentrating upon the possibility of a reality of something known anciently as spirit, psyche, soul? How much? There are vampires out there looking to feed on us. Every time I turn on a television set, which, thank God, is only every few years, when the advertisements come on, I don't watch this stuff very often. So when the ads come on, it chills me to the bone. I mean, it's like dark figures coming out from behind little columns with, you know, their teeth. Give me your money. Let me find a way to get your money. Let me throw sexy images at you. Let me throw speeding cars and noisy. Let me show you images of you driving a 4x4 through southern Utah, destroying that delicate earth, putting tire tracks that will exist for centuries out there on that virgin land. Let me show you that so that you'll feel like you can be free if only you give me your money and take a loan for $40,000 that will enslave you to make payments monthly probably beyond the ability of your salary. You can be free too if you are willing to allow a vampire to suck on you a bit. Okay, I accept that I'm a bit weird, but that's how I see it. And we all get caught on that. We all get caught up in it. And so the Lord in this dialogue, I suspect in the beginning part of the dialogue that's missing, he was talking about spirit and matter. And he asked, what's matter? And he says, Lord, will it last forever? I mean, the disciples are asking an honest question. Is this going to last forever? Are we going to be resurrected in this flesh? Are we going to last forever as physical beings in a, you know, in these vessels with their warts and slightly crooked ears? And are we? And he says, look, everything's going to be resolved to its root. All that is composed shall decompose. Everything returns to its root. But what's implied here? What's missing in the earlier pages, we can assume, there's something else that has a root in this world. It's spirit. Spirit has a root too. Spirit's root is different than matter's root. In the perception of these ancient Christians, there was an eternal reality outside physical, material reality. Apart from it, not a product of it. And it, too, would resolve to its root. So when it says all things resolve to its root, folks, this flesh, this cosmos, this sun, this moon, these stars, toast. They will resolve to their root. Dust to dust. But there's something else here that will resolve to its root as well. That is spirit. That is light. That is consciousness. It is not a product of this cosmos. It dwells here. But this dwelling will die. Now, that might be bad news. If we identify ourselves, if we know ourselves only in terms of the dwelling, might be good news. It might be good news if we know that this thing of spirit in us, that is the true constituent of our reality, will return to its root. That this place and its suffering and its turmoils and its preoccupation and its vampiric forces seeking to feed upon life. Because, my friends, blood and life and light dwell in us, and those vampires want it. If we understand the root of that, well, now we have awakened. And this is the Gnostic message. Then Peter goes on in the Gospel of Mary. He says, since you have become the interpreter of the elements and the events of the world, tell us. This is Peter talking to the Lord. You've become the interpreter of the elements and the events of the world. Tell us, what is sin in this world? Good question. Answer. The teacher answered, there is no sin. It is you who make sin exist. When you act according to the habits of your corrupted nature, this is where sin lies. This is why the good has come into your midst. It acts together with the elements of your nature so as to reunite it with its roots. Then he continued, this is why you become sick and why you die. It is the result of your actions. What you do takes you further away. Those who have ears, let them hear. So where does sin come from? Sin comes from our attachment to the corrupt, to the thing which is corruptible, which crumbles, which falls apart, which rots, which dies. Sin is our identification with an immense concentration upon issues of physicality. The issue of money, of sex, of relationship, of job, our concerns about the things that will die. As opposed to the thing that does not die. We sin when we forget the root that is our source. The true tissue of our reality, which, once again, in the perspective of these ancient Christians, was a thing of spirit that existed before. Traditionally get a bad rap in Western historical discussions for being anti-material. How dare you be anti-material? How dare you naysay anything in this world? Okay. How dare you? Well, I don't know. I dare. I take care of people who are in deep suffering in this world every day. And I meet many people who naysay their experience of physicality. How dare they? It's their experience. It's a bit of my experience, too. This tradition did naysay a bit of the importance of the world, of matter. But at the same time, it did so in reflection of a different perception. To understand the Gospel of Mary of Magdala, it's important to understand the role of the feminine in the Gnostic mythos. Because the feminine is very much hooked up with the issue of the spirit indwelling this world. I spoke a little bit about the myth of Sophia, and just in great briefness. Sophia begins to appear as a figure in Jewish mysticism 200 years before Christ. in what is known as the wisdom liturgy, she starts appearing, and we find her as a figure, a feminine figure, who's present with the divine at creation. It is suggested that she is the agent, active agent, in creation in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, the apocryphal literature of the Old Testament. Her myth proceeds to take form in early Christian literature. And the myth actually becomes very complex. In most general summary, it's like this. In the very beginning, the divine existed in its totality, undivided. And since it was not divided, it really had nothing to be conscious of. It was full consciousness, and it was totally unconscious because it was everything and nothing. To know that you're everything, there has to be a nothing. But if you're everything and nothing, what's to define? If there's only one, how can you speak of two? If there's only one and everything's part of it, what's relationship? There seems to have been in Gnostic perception this vast mystical perception of a unity once that was undivided and whole and eternal and complete. But not necessarily awake. It awakened. It became self-aware. It opened its eye. Its eye of knowing itself. These are cosmic myths. Ancient myths. Myths that go far beyond, I shouldn't say cosmic, they're pre-cosmic myths. These are psychological perceptions of consciousness coming to terms with its own self, with its own reality. It opens its eye and it sees something. And this thing is often in Gnostic mythology given female gender. Male gender, female gender. This is the self-knowing of the divine. When the first reality's eye opened and it became self-aware, that awareness had a feminine quality. She was the first one. She was what he saw. She was the first awakening. That she flows down in these pre-cosmic myths in various forms, various names, and she flows down usually in relationship to a syzygy, to a second half that is masculine. There are pairs that come down as this consciousness takes form, increasingly defined and present form. These elements move down into the reality of our world until they take form in the Logos, Jesus, and Sophia. Now, these myths are not meant as histories. They're not meant as anything but stories of our own reality. Because, you see, if we contain in us this divine spark, which is eternal and divine, its story is our story. Our story here. Sophia, in these myths, becomes attracted to a light shining off in the distance. And she turns to it and projects some of herself into it, thinking that there's an image of the divine there. She goes to it, and from herself, without relationship to the supernal realm, she makes a creation. This creation in Gnostic mythology is called the Demiurge, the lesser creator. He's called ignorant and blind. He thinks he's the only god there is, the god above all gods, but he's jealous. He doesn't even know what he's jealous of, but he's jealous. There might be something more than him. He is the child of Sophia. Sophia entered into the realm of creation. Her first creation is an abortion. He goes around creating everything else. And everything is sort of in thrall of him, connected with him, enslaved to him. Except Sophia knows that he is an abortion, that he is incomplete, that he is a monster. And she seeks the light that has flown through him into creation. She seeks to redeem it. She is here with us. She is present in the created realm, seeking to draw these sparks of light back to their source. Now, this is not a history. It's a psychology. Let me put it in slightly different terms. Think of it, actually, maybe just think of it in entirely material terms, evolutionary terms. Because the Gnostics would not have been opposed to this. They looked at the story of matter as a reflection of the story of spirit. Everything we know as history is secondary to a pre-existing story. You know, in our modern world, in our consciousness, we think of History is real, and story is something you make up about history. In the Gnostic view, it's turned upside down. Story is real. The story is really real. And history is something made up about the story. That all history, all these facts that we see are really vague shadowings of the story, the real thing. Okay, so human beings come forth on this little speck of dust, floating around in some amazingly precisely blessed situation relative to infinite light and infinite coldness. I mean, here's a planet caught just at the point between the incredible fire of the sun and the indescribable coldness of the dark nothing. Just at a point where on it, organic chemical reactions can take place and life can begin to form. A little bit closer to the sun, the energy burns it all. A little bit further, the coldness turns it all to ice. So here's this little speck circling around a globe. And on it, organic processes start to take place. This is our story. I mean, there was a big bang before the big ball of fire that is our sun formed, and then all the cosmic dust sort of had to come together due to gravitational and physical forces. But by some amazing fact, there's one little speck of dust propitiously centered in orbit, just close enough to the light, just far enough from infinite cold, and life forms. Life forms here. One day, before there were days, actually, because who was counting days before the first counter of days? Do squirrels count days? Rabbits? Lions? They make calendars and count days and think about it, think about their lives, their term, their befores and afters. One day, the first day, something stood up on this earth and looked and saw it. Saw it, saw her, awakened, became conscious of self. We call it that thing, human. And we call that day the beginning of humanity. That was the moment when we became conscious of who we were. And we started asking the questions. Is this so different than the story of Sophia? Where did this consciousness come from? Well, when this consciousness arose here on earth, it immediately perceived a greater source. All of human cultures relate how when consciousness takes form, human consciousness takes form, it senses that it has relationship to something up there in the stars, something deeply hidden in the earth, an animism, a mystical participation, but a sense that its consciousness is not it's alone, but shared. But there's another trend in this consciousness, which is to take matter that it sees and start making tools from it, start making houses and defending those houses with sticks that are sharpened, with bows and arrows, with guns, with bombs, with atomic energy. We manipulate this world. And this consciousness, cast loose in this world, becomes something of a demiurge. It says, there is no God but me. I'm it. I'm boss. I rule. I make the rules and I create things. I created all of this. I. My I. That's the demiurge. Gnostic mythology. You see, it's a type of psychology. But it's a depth psychology. It's a transpersonal psychology. It tells the story of consciousness here in terms of the fact that its source is not here. It's transpersonal. It's trans-cosmic, pre-cosmic. In fact, it's the real reality. Its reality, its story, is forming his story, this story, our story. Okay? You cannot understand the Gnostic mythos until you understand this perspective. And when you read these stories of the soul's ascension, when you read the story of Mary of Magdala, understand that, yes, there's history here. The important thing in the Gnostic view is not the history. It's the story. And that story is our story as well. Okay. One last word about sex. I know you were waiting. I promise. Okay. All that aside, I mean, this thing about, you know, Jesus and Mary. Well, were they or weren't they? Were they or weren't they? I mean, you know, were they or weren't they? Okay. Remember, I spoke last week about Gnostic hermeneutics, the art of interpreting Scripture, hermeneutics. Heracleion, Valentinian Gnostic, had three ways of interpreting a text. He said, you know, there's the Hilletic way. You can look at it as history, as, you know, physical facts, how things happened, he said, she said, they did, and that's it. There's a second way. You can accept the fact that there are historical facts, actions, but that they had moral means, that from them we derive morals, behavioral dictums. But then there's a third way. It's the spiritual interpretation, the pneumatic interpretation, which does not deny the fact that there may have been history, real human beings doing real things, but their history is a reflection of the real reality, which is the story of this life, coming to this realm, passing through this realm, seeking his redemption in a realm beyond this realm. So were Jesus and Mary man and wife? Maybe. Were they girlfriend, boyfriend? Maybe. But you see, that is the Hilletic interpretation. Of course, that is the fixation of our world. I mean, if we're going to find anything mystical lost in Christianity at the Hilletic level, what we're going to do is say, Christianity got the story all wrong. This Christ, he wasn't like this celibate guy. I mean, the real mystery was that he married and they had children, that these physical children continued to live here on earth and became kings of France and such, and carried some mystical knowledge and made funny puzzles with rings that turn and things. And when you open the ring, you know, you get a piece of paper that goes and it takes you to a place underneath some museum in Paris somewhere. And in that hole down there, you're going to find something mysterious. And what are you going to find down that hole? Mysterious? Well, actually, in the Da Vinci Code, I think what you found there were the Nag Hammadi library books. I mean, that's the implication you get. Okay? That's a Hilletic. Then what would be the spiritual interpretation of that? That there is a logos. There is a power of mind, a word. The word is the verb. Verbos, logos in Greek. Verbos in Latin. It's the active relationship. What does a verb do? It relates a subject. It's an object. The verb is the action of relation between two things. There's a verb, a logos. And there's a relationship in that word. And that relationship is Sophia. She is wisdom, light, life, awakened realization. She was with this Lord at the beginning. She was the first consort, the first reality of his own self-knowledge. She's here. The active word unifies with her. In that union of wisdom, in that union, there is a generative act. From that union comes something new, a new child, new humankind. That child is a king. That child is a queen. That child is royal beyond all imagination. Royal in the sense of given lineage, a lineage that precedes this world. So, were Jesus and Mary mixed up? Yeah, they were mixed up. But in the pneumatic way, not only are they mixed up, they're still mixed up. And you know those children, those royal children that were going to be the kings and queens? My friends, you are they. You are that royal lineage. So, the Gnostics would read that story. So I'll stop there, and I thank you very much for your interest and attention, and I will be glad to take any questions.
exhausted your potentials. Yes, sir.
That's the complex question. If I step back to this spiritual reading of history, in other words, that history is really a manifestation of the story, that then you see if the story exists, even if it only exists in our imagination collectively, so as an archetypal formation in Jungian psychology, as a collective image that we share, we bear inside of us. If we have an image inside of us that rings true, might we not read all external events as reflections of that image? Might we not project the internal image into external events? I don't know if that makes sense. You see, if you think that there's a story of a royal wedding or a divine king, and that is part of your human nature to see or understand such stories, then you might read history in terms of that story. You might see it. And this is a criticism that, or at least an issue, that runs throughout stories of, runs throughout studies of history, of historiography. In other words, how do you write history? What is history? I mean, what is fact? What is story? What is history in between fact and the stories told of facts? Ultimately, human activity across the span of this globe over millennia is a random chaos. And yet, history tries to order it. We try to read the facts into some sort of an ordered form. Well, where's the order coming from? Is it in the facts themselves or is it in us? Do we impose, project a story upon it? Up until the last two centuries, history was all story. If you read histories written in the Middle Ages, they're stories. They're stories entirely made up. Oh, yeah, they have pieces here and there of conveyed tradition about things that actually happened. But all the pieces are put together by a forming motif. Okay. All sorts of books look at ancient history and try to form stories of them. And some of the books are really very speculative. They take in an intuitive sense of what the story would be. They take the pieces that can be found here and there in the scrap pile of historical fact and order those facts into some sort of logical construct. An example would be Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which suggests that Jesus and Mary were married. Mary went to France, carried the child of Jesus. And they just pull all these, you know, things out of history and that don't necessarily have connection or even make sense in any rigorous reading of the facts and make a story. Now, when you get to the formations of Christianity, that far back, there's some people that project some pretty weird stories onto it and construct some things that they call history that are entirely, in my opinion, entirely speculations born of active imagination, which is not to criticize the imagination. Some of those imaginations are pretty interesting if you look at them as that. These are imaginations. Science fiction stories are pretty interesting. There's stuff in them that stimulates us to think. They're fictions, but they're good stories. If you go back into Christian origins, there's a whole lot of that. However, that apart, it is absolutely apparent that there was, at the formation of Christianity, a pre-existing tradition, apart from what we understand as rabbinical Judaism. There was a mystical tradition in Judaism, forming, that was very much centered upon the coming of a Messiah. that had very strong visionary inclinations. And indeed, some of the literature that we now have in the Nag Hammadi Library, including some of the core parts of the Apocryphon of John, may actually be related to a vision tradition that existed before the formation of Christianity in Judaism. What sort of Jews were these? Well, they weren't the type that, you know, we call Pharisees and Sadducees. They were more sectarians, maybe related to those who are thought to have existed in Essene communities, occasionally related to the Dead Sea Scrolls, those sorts of folks. They were people that formed a literature known as the Enoch literature, a visionary literature. And there is a broad literature of these people, that pieces of which survived in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So they existed. In Egypt, there was a mystical tradition very much like the Gnostic tradition that had an image of the Logos. In this tradition, Thoth played a very important role as the messenger of the gods. Within Greek culture, there was a mystery religion tradition that flowed and integrated into Christianity. And this is perhaps the one we are most familiar with. In early Christian iconography, Dionysius often is confounded with Christ in iconographical signs. Many of the elements we find in early Christian iconography have direct lineage in Greek mystery religion. In the Socratic tradition, the Platonic tradition, there was a very religiously toned experiential movement in Middle Platonism around the time of Philo of Judea, around the time of Jesus, and in late Platonic thought, that looked for an experience of the divine, a revelatory experience. And for these people, philosophy was really love of Sophia, Philo, Sophia. And Sophia was the wisdom of the divine, and it was an actual experience. It was an enlightening event of which these people, including Plotinus, give testimony. It happened. All of these traditions gave strands of their past to the new present of forming Christianity. There were Christians who had relations to prior mystical mystery religion traditions in the Greek culture. There were certainly those in Hellenistic Egypt, Greek Egypt, who had relation to the deep and profound religious traditions of Egypt. Certainly, they had relations to some of the apocalyptic, visionary traditions of Judaism. All this stuff got mixed up in Christianity. Deciphering where the strings go is beyond real history. It becomes more storytelling. It becomes more intuition. And some of those intuitions may actually be true. But to claim that they have proof of their truth is to step outside the bounds of anything that we would call history. They're still interesting. Okay.
How much real documentation is there that relates to the struggle of the founding of Orthodoxy? You can see the problem that might have existed in near 200 or 300 as people began to sort through, saying some of this is urban legends, some of this is actual gospel. Mm-hmm. How do we differentiate? I don't imagine there were conference proceedings published, but there must be something that was recorded at the time with regard to considerations for including and excluding.
Yeah, not much until the late 2nd century, around 180 to 200. There are fragments of letters. You have to understand that the earliest copy we have of canonical texts, the things that became the New Testament, date to the 4th century. There are two codices. There's called the Codex Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And these two are the two oldest surviving copies of the New Testament. You know, surviving paper of an age that relates back to the 4th century. That's the oldest. Before the 4th century, there are only scraps of papyrus, Christian documents. What we have occasionally are copies of copies of copies of a few things. And we have a few letters that date from, you know, the first century, late first century and early second century. The oldest documents we have are the Pauline documents. And then we have the text from Nag Hammadi. These are some of the oldest Christian documents we own. I mean, they are as early as the earliest copies of canonical texts as far as dating of the paper and ink there. So how do you put them all together? You're left with a whole lot of space to make things up. It's what it comes down to. That's why it's such a rich area for scholars, because people can bring up all sorts of hypotheses, and it's very hard to disprove. As long as you throw in enough references and seem erudite enough, you can get away with a whole lot of speculation in much of these, you know, studies. So, you know, we really don't know anything about the ritual practices of early Christianity. We have no idea what happened inside a Christian Eucharistic service through the 4th century. I mean, Augustine, the bishop and, you know, founder of one of the most important strains of Christian mysticism, writes absolutely nothing about his liturgical life. He writes a lot, but he writes nothing about what his liturgy, what he did as a bishop, what rituals he did. We don't know anything about that. We have only the vaguest idea of what these Christians did when they got together. And as far as what they said and what they taught, the Nag Hammadi Library is a good representation of some of the things that they were passing around. Orthodox preserved canonical texts certainly were in circulation. That's what we have. So, you know, it's fragmentary. And one can't really say anything other at this point than that there was a huge amount more diversity in the first two centuries of Christianity than we would have been led to think by approaches to this history that have dominated for the last millennium.
Yeah, but sheer diversity doesn't mean anything by way of validity and authentication.
Absolutely nothing. But what's validity? I mean, you say, what's valid? Well, is the Hellenic definition valid? Is if this man said, if Jesus said this to this man, this man said this to this man, this man said this to this man, this man said this to this man, and this man wrote it down, that's valid. But if Jesus said this to this man said this to this man changed it and made something up and added to it and then told it to this man wrote it down, then that's invalid. You know, because ultimately, we don't have anything that Jesus wrote. So every you know, idea about validity has to do with lineage of transmission.
Yeah, sure.
And every lineage of transmission involves physical touch and verbal communication and perhaps written but lost communication. Those lines are gone.
But it's like your own family history. You can describe this being said by so-and-so and so-and-so, and maybe that some of it is true, some of it is not true. But at least you have a provenance.
Yes, provenance. Well, yes, and indeed I'd say that most of the Gnostic literature has a provenance for validity.
Right.
I mean, like Thomas has a pretty good provenance for validity. Certainly the Gospel of John has a good provenance for...
But in the case of the Gospel of Mary, what is the provenance?
The provenance is we have a piece of paper. Okay, we have a piece of paper found in a back alley of Cairo in 1890.
Yeah.
Where it came from, we have absolutely no idea.
Right, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Except it's pretty certain that the text was written in ancient Coptic. Mm-hmm. It's pretty certain that it was probably written in the second century.
Right. Right.
It relates to several other documents of similar nature. And documents with earlier provenance. But you could say the same thing about most, just about the entire canonical literature. We have no provenance before the, you know, probably second century for any canonical text. We have no, we have only fragmentary written copies of anything before the, you know, 180, 190.
Is there any record of what was mandated to be destroyed and excluded?
Yeah.
So there is that record.
Oh, yeah.
So that, you have a library of...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah, yeah. In the late, in that was in the late 3rd century, late 4th century, 300s, 380 period. Yeah, yes, sir.
You mentioned the dead.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of an ambiguous figure? I'm wondering is there any scriptural? I'm not building my Gnostic scripture. Is there any evidence or indication of his salvation?
Yeah, okay. The demiurge is seen as a mythic figure, not a historical figure, a mythic construct of something that is formed when wisdom relates only to its lower functions and potentials without relation to its spiritual potential. The demiurge might be seen psychologically, interpreting Gnostic scriptures in a psychological form, as the human ego that stands up and says, I'm all there is, and forgets the fact that it has a spiritual reality. Is there salvation for the demiurge? Perhaps. I mean, in some Gnostic texts, you get the image that the demiurge is savable. The demiurge, you know, this ego has the potential of understanding that there is something more than it and returning to its reality, to its true reality. So maybe, yes, there is salvation. To see the demiurge, however, as a historical figure or even meta-historical figure of metaphysical reality is to misread the psychological intention of the story. So is there salvation for the demiurge? Perhaps. It's a psychological question, and it certainly was given contemplation.